Ecclesiastes chapter 1, it's in the Old Testament, immediately following Proverbs, right before Song of Solomon. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, last week, if you were here, you know we began a study in this book, and we basically saw that everything is hopeless and pointless and worthless, and there's no point in living anymore, right? No, we saw that the preacher, as he is called, Kohelet in the Hebrew, which we believe is Solomon. He identifies himself as the son of David, king in Jerusalem. We saw last week in the first 11 verses that everything is a vapor. It's all passing away. Everything is very temporary in this life. It's difficult for us to really get our hands around anything, and yet at the same time, there's a purpose in it all. We see that, and we saw that by going to the very end of the book last week. But I would encourage you this morning to pick up your Bible and look there in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. We're going to begin reading in verse 12 this morning, and we will read down through the end of chapter 1. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, beginning in verse 12, the scripture says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. On March 14, 2004, Daniel Tammet broke the European record for reciting pi from memory. Pi is the mathematical equation, the mathematical constant, that is the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter. For 5 hours and 9 minutes, Daniel recited 22,514 digits, 3.14 and on and on and on the rest, without error. Tammet suffers from, if that's really the appropriate phrase to use here, he suffers from Asperger syndrome, and this condition allows him to be extraordinary in activities such as memorizing numbers and learning languages. He learned the Icelandic language in little over a week. I mean, just an incredible capacity for this type of things. And such brilliance, however, has its drawbacks. In his memoir titled Born on a Blue Day, Inside the Extraordinary Mind of an Autistic Savant, he recalls, and I quote, I still remember vividly the experience I had as a teenager lying on the floor of my room, staring up at the ceiling. I was trying to picture the universe in my head, to have a concrete understanding of what everything was. In my mind, I traveled to the edges of existence and looked over them, wondering what I would find. In that instant, I felt really unwell, and I could feel my heart beating hard inside me, because for the first time, I had realized that thought and logic had its limits and could only take a person so far. This realization frightened me, and it took me a long time to come to terms with it. End quote. In Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 12 to 18, we witness the brilliant King Solomon flat on the floor, on his back, staring up at the ceiling, unnerved by the frightening realization of the limits of human wisdom. But before we gaze up with him, I believe we should sort of set the context and see the structure of the text that's before us. Ecclesiastes 1:12 through the end of chapter 2 is really a New textual unit. You really have an introduction to the book in chapter 1, verses 1 through 11. We dealt with that last week. In fact, I learned some in just education, and some I learned from my dad and what he said he was told in the Air Force. Said, if you're going to get up and give a speech or give a briefing or whatever the oral event is going to be, you have three different parts. You have an introduction, you have a body, and you have a conclusion. Or as my dad used to say, you get up and you tell them what you're going to tell them, you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them, and you sit down and shut up. And in Ecclesiastes, you kind of have that structure. You have the beginning, you have the introduction there in the first 11 verses, really all of chapter 1. You almost have sort of a double introduction here, but then you have the body, and then you have a conclusion to this book. Really, Ecclesiastes is a sermon that's being preached by Solomon. He refers to himself as the preacher. And so we need to understand that chapter 1, verse 12, through the end of chapter 2, it really is kind of a new textual unit. And it contains a number of the same phrases that we've already seen in the beginning of this book. And we can be certain that the key question of verse 3 is still being answered, because the Hebrew word for toil is used 15 times just in this section alone. And the question, if I could remind you, from verse 3 is simply this: what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? But what's new, starting with verse 12, is the theme of wisdom through reflection, as Solomon walks us through his own autobiography in a certain type of way. So for the first time in Ecclesiastes, we find the word I, as in I the preacher in verse 12, and I applied my heart in verse 13, and I have seen in verse 14, and I said in my heart, I have acquired in verse 16. I applied my heart and I perceived, both of those, in verse 17. And then in addition to that, for the first time in this book, we see the words wise and wisdom. Now, these words are used 53 times throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, and they're used 17 times in this section alone. If you add to those words wise and wisdom, words that are sort of synonymous with them, or words that are relatively close linguistically, that count for this section rises from 17 to 23. This is the highest. You might say, well, Josh, this is just a whole lot of numbers and a whole lot of, why don't you just stick a graph up on the wall? The reason I'm telling you this is because this is the highest concentration of wisdom words in the entire Bible. Not just in Ecclesiastes, but in the entire Word of God. There is no question that this section is about wisdom. But the second thing I want you to see before we really dive into this text, I want you to see the structure of the text. I don't often do this in a sermon, but I'm going to invite you in your mind to walk out of this room, walk down the hallway, and walk into my office on a Tuesday morning with me and sit down at my desk. You can look over my shoulder. I want to give you a little bit of a view that I don't often give in a sermon, and it may be a little simplistic, but I want to just sort of give you a behind-the-scenes glimpse of what's going on here. Because as in most other Hebrew poetry, the structure is simple. It may seem complicated as we read these few verses, but it's really a very simple structure, or what I think we should probably call simple beauty, just simply beautiful. After an introduction statement in verse 12, where he says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, there follow two reflections, each of which gives us a statement about the vanity of pursuing wisdom, followed by a proverb that supports that statement. And so an outline form of this passage might look something like this. It'd just be very simple, just two main points. There's a first reflection, a first observation that Solomon's going to make. There's a second observation that he makes. And basically, he's doing the same thing in both. He says, pursuing wisdom is vanity. And here's a proverb in verse 15 to back that up, to support what I'm saying. And my second reflection is that pursuing wisdom and folly is also vanity. And here's a proverb in verse 18 to back that up. And then the chapter closes. So from this simple structure, it's easy to find and to summarize exactly what Solomon is doing here, exactly the message that he's trying to give to us, and to sort of summarize what Solomon discovered about wisdom. His first reflection is that wisdom can't change reality. And his second is that wisdom can increase sorrow. So with that, let's just look at the passage and look at the message that Solomon's giving us here. And the first thing he says is wisdom cannot change reality. You really see this after that little introduction there in verse 12. Verses 13, 14, and 15 really lay this bare. In this world, those who follow Jesus never really find a permanent home. We find peace with God through Christ, and there's rest for the weary and heavy laden, but the gospel doesn't lead us to a settled life and a contented ease. And that's always been true of God's family. The writer of Hebrews says about Abraham in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 9, by faith he, that is Abraham, went to live in the land of promise as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise, for he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. Folks, in this world, if you are a believer, if you're going to be a believer living in this world, you are always going to be a stranger and a misfit. You're always going to just find yourself just sort of feeling uneasy in the world around you. In fact, Scripture tells us, Jesus tells his disciples, that we are to be in the world, but not of the world. We're to be in the world, we're to work in the world, we're to challenge the world, we're to bring the gospel to bear on the world, and yet we are not of the world. We don't act like them, we don't talk like them, we don't look like them. We're completely different. Why? Because we are living for another kingdom. We are living for another home. This world is not our home. So we're always going to feel like strangers and misfits. We have no permanent roots in this world and no sense of belonging here. We're just traveling through. Or are we? See, the great danger for those of us who follow Christ is that we lose sight of the world to come. We become resident Christians rather than nomadic Christians. We become comfortable. We become fully integrated in this world rather than viewing ourselves as just passing through this world, just a stop along the journey. Now, I can remember growing up, I'm old enough to remember when movie stores were still actually a thing. Those of you who are probably under the age of 20, you probably don't have a clue what a movie store is. You're like, what are you talking about? Just pull your phone out and pull up your Amazon Prime account and just download the movie onto your phone. Well, yes, we can do that now, but they actually used to have these things called VHS players. They had a lot of older stuff before that, but that's sort of my first introduction into it. And I can remember going with my mom or my dad. We'd go right down the road to the movie store and we'd pick out some movies. And there was a movie series titled 5 Mile Creek. It was just sort of stationed in sort of the outback just sort of the wild in Australia. And the story was really around a stagecoach line, and they would run passengers back and forth between these two main points. But they had one point kind of in the middle where they would stop, and they even called it the Haven. And there were ladies there who ran. It was almost sort of like a motel. You know, they had extra horses, and they had places where you could feed and water your horses and do all of those types of things. And so the Haven was just sort of a resting spot. It was a stopping place where you could just sort of stop and recharge your batteries and get ready for the rest of the journey. Well, folks, the day you put your faith and trust in Jesus Christ, your destination is heaven. And earth is just supposed to be a stopping spot in the middle. But I fear for far too many of us as believers, far too many of us would say, we want to make the Haven our home. We're comfortable in the Haven. We like the Haven. We don't want to get on the road and keep going down the road and keep on with the journey. We're just happy here. We're just happy to hang out here. We're happy to just get along with everyone here. And we display our sense of permanence by our lifestyle choices, do we not? Can you not see it in the way that we live and the choices that we make? I mean, just think about the homes we live in. Think about the car you drive, the money we spend, the churches we build, the investments we pursue. Think about the priorities we live for. We hold the good things of this world too tightly, and we lavish our affections on them far too freely. We strive and strain for the same kind of gain as everyone else around us. Jesus knew this would be the temptation for his disciples. And so he said in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 6, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where the thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." You know, I know far too many believers who say today, "Well, you know, I really don't have money for this, or I really don't have money for that, or I really, you know, I just don't have enough time to get involved with this thing or with that thing. I just don't have enough energy here or there." We see this in missions, do we not? Several years ago, I don't know if these stats are still accurate. Several years ago, I heard some stats on just the Southern Baptist Convention. We'll just bring it in home to our home denomination. And the stats were this. Out of every dollar that is given in Southern Baptist offering plates throughout the year, there's some $12 or $13 billion every year that passes through the offering plates of Southern Baptist churches. Out of all of that money that is given, out of all the budgets, out of all the areas that we give and all the stuff that we do, do you know how much of that makes it to international missions? Now, we're not talking about North American missions or stuff in Canada. We're not talking about other, you know, we're not talking about children's homes and camps, and we're not talking about Baptist colleges and all the other stuff that we do, but just the amount of money out of every Southern Baptist dollar that's given, 2.5 cents of every dollar makes it into the nations. Folks, that's pathetic. We should grieve those numbers. And I'm telling you this morning what I was convinced of and what I was convicted of when I heard those numbers and when I went and I looked up those numbers. What that tells me is that we need to get off our can. We need to get out of a pew and we need to go reach lost men and women with the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I believe Jesus says to us in Matthew chapter 6 that if we find that our heart is not in the nations, maybe we ought to pick our wallet up and stick our wallet in the nations and see if our heart doesn't follow it right there. If we do not have a heart to see lost men and women who have never even heard the gospel of Jesus Christ, who have never held a Bible, who don't even know that they are lost and dying and on their way to splitting the gates of hell wide open when they die, because again, remember, like we see in Ecclesiastes, their life is nothing but a breath. It's over in an instant, and they will find themselves burning in the flames of hell for all of eternity, and so many of them have never even heard. God help us. That we not lay up treasures for ourselves, but that we turn it into gold and precious stone, that we invest our treasure in the things that God would have us invest in. And to stop us from doing the wrong kind of storing, and to help us begin to do the right kind of storing, God has given us the book of Ecclesiastes. During the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, there were advertisements on television in England for Hamlet cigars. If you're old enough, you may have seen some of these commercials. If you just enjoy a good laugh, don't take it too seriously. Yes, they're advertising cigars, but you can just look up on Google. You can just Google Hamlet cigar ads, and they've got just over and over and over, just all the ads they ever ran. Some brilliant ads that they ran in just selling products. Incredibly enough, they were recently listed as the 8th greatest advertisement of all time. And there was a recurring pattern to the ads, and usually it had some storyline. There's some poor man, and he's trying to achieve something that went horribly wrong each and every time. No matter how hard he tried, he'd always mess it up. You know, one, this guy's sitting in a photo booth, and he's trying to get just the right picture, and he's got his nice tie and his coat on, and you know, he's He's bald, and so he's grown, you know, all the hair around here, he's got it cut, and then he's grown just a few locks on the side, you know, maybe it hangs down to here, and he's trying to wisp it all up and just make it cover the top of his head. And about the time he gets it just right in place, he smiles, and he waits and waits and waits, and the camera never clicks, and he moves to do something, the hair falls down, and immediately the camera clicks and takes his picture. Several times he tries to do that, and then he just lights up a cigar, and the whole tagline, all of those ads, the guy eventually just resigns himself to failure, and he simply lights up his cigar, and that cues the tagline, "Happiness is a cigar named Hamlet." The ads were a stroke of genius. They made people laugh, and so all their defenses were lowered. They showed us what we know to be true, that life is messy and complicated, and it doesn't always work the way we want it to. And sometimes the best thing you can do is just accept it. They dared to tell us what every ad on TV is telling us. If you have this product, you'll be happy. Whether it's a cigar, whether it's a certain brand of dishwashing liquid, whether it's this brand of blue jeans, whether it's that brand of car, whether it's this kind of house, whatever it is, advertisements are specifically intended to convince us that if we just had that one product, we'd be happy. Quite simply, the ads worked because happiness is what we live for. Blaise Pascal said, "All men seek happiness. This is without exception. Whatever different means they use, they all tend to this end. The cause of some going to war and others avoiding it is the same desire in both, to be happy. This is the motive of every action of every man, even those who hang themselves." Just about everything you've done so far today was to make yourself happy. Now, you may have done some things that you just had to do, things that you didn't really want to do, but by and large, most of the decisions that you have made today, you have made those decisions because you want to be happy. You've fed yourself. Maybe you stayed in the shower a little longer than normal because you heard the kids fighting and arguing downstairs and you just didn't want to deal with it for a minute, and so you just took a little extra long shower. Maybe I'm looking around the room. I don't think I have to say maybe. Each and every one of you at some point this morning got up and somebody dressed you. Somebody put clothes on your body. We'd have major problems if you didn't. If you can, for the rest of the day, you're going to do what makes you happy. What we long for and live for is happiness. On the surface of our lives and at the deepest level of our lives, in all our varied pursuits, earning a living, finding a spouse, raising good children, having fun, keeping fit, we exhibit a common desire to be happy in what we do. We don't simply exist suspended motionless in time. We shape and we try to change the world around us. We seek to control it. And we plan and dream about our individual lives. We live with a purpose toward a specific end, and we have a goal, and that goal is to be happy. Now, the preacher in Ecclesiastes is the same as us. He set out to explore all that is done under heaven, and he was determined to find out what is good. And by the way, if you don't think being happy is a very spiritual, noble pursuit, I would encourage you to go pick up a copy of John Piper's Desiring God and just allow him to convince you with his argument that God desires your happiness. And you know where you're going to be happiest most? When you find your complete satisfaction in his son, Jesus Christ. That's exactly where you're going to find it. So happiness is not antithetical to the gospel. Happiness is the heart of the gospel. And God just knows the only way that you are ever truly going to be joyful and happy for eternity is to put your faith and trust in Jesus Christ. In chapter 2, Solomon tells us that he wanted to see what is good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. His was a request for satisfaction and meaning in life, and he pursued it by giving himself to wisdom, comedy, pleasure, alcohol, projects, possessions. I mean, as we work ourselves through this book, Solomon is going to try his hand at everything. And as he did so, he held happiness in his hands, and then it slipped through his fingers like water and vanished down the drain forever. See, even wisdom has certain limitations and liabilities. 140 years ago, our culture was rather confident that we could accomplish great, mighty things through human wisdom. Listen to this quote from William Kingdon Clifford from 1879. It's pretty typical of that era, with all its confidence and progress and science. Clifford said, "Remember that science is the guide of action, that the truth which science arrives at, we may act on without fear. And remembering these things, you cannot fail to see that scientific thought is not an accompaniment or condition of human progress. It is human progress itself." Now that's confidence, is it not? Scientific thought is human progress in and of itself. Well, I'm here to suggest to you this morning that one or two things may have changed a little bit over the last 140 years. The people of that period thought they saw on the horizon the end of all humanity's problems. In fact, there was a president who came along not too long after that quote was given, who began a League of Nations, and who believed that when he entered the United States into the First World War, that it was going to be the war to end all wars. Here we are in 2019. We've had another world war. We've had a Vietnam War. We've had a Korean War. We have had the Afghanistan and Iraqi War. And that's just the wars this country has been involved in, and I haven't even covered them all. Not to mention all the other conflicts and all the other stuff and all the other garbage that's been going on around this planet in the last 140 years. So one of our modern philosophers, Sting, can say this. You could say, "I've lost my faith in science and progress. I've never saw no miracle of science that didn't go from a blessing to a curse." The whole perspective on the ultimate victory of science, human wisdom to supply the meanings of life and solve the problems of life, has crumbled before our very eyes in a postmodern age. But thousands of years before our cynical culture came to this point, the author of Ecclesiastes had seen that, and he said that if you're looking for the ultimate hope in what human wisdom can bring, in what human wisdom can supply, apart from God, you ain't gonna find it. It's not anywhere close enough to you to find. If you're looking for the ultimate hope in human wisdom, apart from God, it is nowhere to be found. Whether we like it or not, Solomon had busied himself with discovering tragic truths and uncovering them for us. After he discovers human wisdom, even his own famous wisdom, can't undo the curse of a sovereign God on Adam's offspring, his search continues. And as we turn to verses 16 to 18, we shouldn't expect, I mean, I don't mean to be a Debbie Downer, but don't expect a happy ending here. Like, this is not getting better for a while until we get to the end of the book, because notice what he says in verses 16 to 18. He says that wisdom can increase sorrow. Wisdom can increase sorrow. In one of Bill Watterson's classic comic strips, the curious boy Calvin asks Hobbes, who's his stuffed tiger who comes to life in his own imagination. He says, "Hobbes, why do you suppose we're here?" And they're both sitting on the ground, leaning against a large tree, and Hobbes replies, "Well, because we walked here." Calvin says, "No, Hobbes, I don't mean that. I mean, like, why are we here on this earth?" And Hobbes replies, "Well, because earth can support life." And Calvin says, "Hobbes, that's not what I'm getting at. I'm trying to get at the point, like, why are we anywhere? Like, why do we exist?" And again, Hobbes comments, "Because we were born." And frustrated, Calvin moves around to the other side of the tree, lowers his head, and he says, "Just forget it." And Hobbes concludes, "I will, thank you." You know, we all know the escapists who, like Hobbes, avoid answering or even trying to answer the questions of Ecclesiastes. Our world is filled with escapists. Who knows, you may even be one here this morning. Surely plenty of people take on the ancient sages' task of observing the world. We have our psychologists, we have sociologists and anthropologists and zoologists and botanists and astrophysicists and other scientists who examine everything from black holes to brown moles. But there are so few, even from those professions, who stop and observe and reflect on or even consider what we're doing here on planet Earth. They're like Hobbes. They're masterful at avoiding life's larger than an old oak tree questions. Maybe you've had the experience I've had, whether it's talking to a new neighbor or somebody along the street that you've met, and once they learn you're a Christian, they ask you a question or two about your faith, and when you're finished answering those questions, they might say politely, "Well, that's nice," and they have zero interest in Jesus Christ. And then when you question him about his views on the ultimate issues of life, he just nonchalantly replies, "Well, you know, I really haven't given that much thought to that type of thing." Now, that answer is normal enough. That's how people talk because that's how people think. What's not normal is why our culture thinks that that reply is acceptable. I don't know about you, but I'm not impressed by a well-educated, middle-aged man who holds no ideas whatsoever on how we got here, why we are here, and where we're going after the doctor pulls the sheet over our dead bodies. People think and talk like that guy, and other people let them think and talk like that guy. Some might even be impressed by their agnosticism. Well, I'm not. And I invite you this morning to come join me in my intellectual contempt. I heard about a debate between a Christian and an atheist in which an atheist said, "Look, there is no ultimate meaning to life. And the sooner we accept that, the sooner we can get on with living." Well, if there's no ultimate meaning to life, what's the point of getting on with life? We might as well just put a noose around all of our necks and end it all. If there's no ultimate meaning, what's the point of it all? Man looks at the world, he looks at history, he looks at the struggle, the search for meaning, for gain, for satisfaction in the lives of individuals, and what does he see? He sees people frustrated by problems that can't be solved. He looks at people seeking to attain things that they can't attain, and that failure frustrates them. And the more they know, the more frustrated they become. The physician, the neurosurgeon, he's trained, he's the best in his field. And yet there are some people who walk into his office and they have a problem he can't solve. And so the word that he gives to them is, "I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do." With all his knowledge, with all his wisdom, he simply cannot solve every problem. And the wise man is more acutely aware of those problems in our world than the person who is unreflective. So wisdom doesn't really help solve that problem for him. It presses that problem more and more and more into his face and into his consciousness. So we're frustrated by the insolvable, and we have an ambition for the unattainable. And when we consider life under the sun, wisdom cannot supply the meaning of it. One man said, "The more you understand, the more you ache." Doctors have to learn to manage that type of knowledge. And sometimes they know things that if you knew, you would give up all hope. Sometimes they have to figure out how to be honest with you and yet not tell you all the details so as not to crush the hope and the energy that you are going to need to fight that disease, whatever it is. And they've got to figure out some way to know that there's nothing they can do and yet not crush your spirit and not crush your energy. And their knowledge is a grief to them because they know fully what you're facing and they know how serious it is. Knowledge, so far from being the answer, the solution to the problems of life, is sometimes the very stuff of grief in life. Now, the problem with Solomon's exploration was that he didn't stop with wisdom. He also considered its opposite, which he refers to as madness and folly in verses 16, 17, and 18. Now, just as wisdom and knowledge are synonyms, so are madness and folly, with the latter two meaning not the study of insanity, but the pursuit of immoral pleasures, the pursuit of those things that God has forbidden. And in Ecclesiastes 9:3, madness is equated with evil. And as we'll find out in the next chapter, Solomon stockpiled wisdom, and he also amassed amusements. And with wisdom in one hand and folly in the other, he couldn't grasp the meaning of life. This also was but a striving after wind. In fact, when he finished trying wisdom and then trying folly, he found that tasting from the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, as we see in Genesis 2:17, only increased his sorrow. The ignorance of innocence is indeed bliss, but the awareness of evil is an awful vexation. As a professional musician is pained by hearing the first note screeched out in that first lesson from that little girl's first violin lesson, so Solomon is pained by all that he's experienced under the sun. The more he's seen, the more he's pierced by the thorns and thistles of the fall. Several years ago, a pastor told a story from his childhood during an address in Chicago. And he talked about he and his family had all enjoyed playing Monopoly when they were on family vacations when he was growing up. And he said it kind of became a family game because his grandma would just slaughter everybody at Monopoly. He said for all the grandkids, they all wanted to beat grandma. She was the best at it. She always won. And so all the grandkids always wanted to play grandma at Monopoly. And just kid after kid after kid were just steamrolled by grandma. I mean, she just beat them all. And this preacher said, you know, finally I got to about the age of 15 or so, and he grasped the genius of the game. He realized you can't hold on to all your cash. You've got to buy property so that you can charge others rent. And that's how you make more money. And he started to figure out what grandma had always known and how grandma had just continued to beat him over the years. And so on one family vacation, he began this game with his grandmother. And for the first time ever, he began to win. And the adrenaline started pumping. And he wanted to clean her clock. He wanted to clean her out of every property and every Monopoly dollar she had. And eventually, he did just that. She was left penniless and propertyless in the game, and he was exulting in this victory that had won in his over his beloved grandmother, and he was just dancing around having the greatest time. I finally beat grandma at Monopoly. And as he was exulting, she took the money and the board pieces, folded the board together, and poured it all back in the box, and said, "Now that you've learned the secret of winning the game, there's one more lesson you need to learn. When the game is over, it all goes back in the box." And that is what Solomon is saying in the book of Ecclesiastes. It doesn't matter how wise you are. If you live this life apart from God, this is the one truth you must face. When the game is over, it all goes back in the box. In fact, you will go back in the box. And Solomon says you'll be forgotten. See, only transcendent wisdom can meet the demands of a transcendent reality. And that's why Jesus is the only wisdom that can make life meaningful. See, wisdom, true wisdom, leads to what only God can give. And King Solomon was widely known for his wisdom and his great works. Even the Queen of Sheba heard of his fame. She traveled many miles to hear him. She praised the Lord. In 1 Kings chapter 10, it said, "Blessed be the Lord your God, who is delighted in you and set you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord loved Israel forever, he has made you king, that you may execute justice and righteousness." Solomon, Salam, the King of Peace, ruled wisely in the city of peace, Jerusalem. King Solomon is a type of the great King of Peace. He prefigures Jesus Christ. When some people asked Jesus for a sign to prove that he was special, Jesus responded in Matthew chapter 12, "The queen of the south will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, something greater than Solomon is here." Jesus is another Solomon, the great and wise king, but Jesus is much greater than Solomon. Jesus teaches us to pray to our Father in heaven, "Give us this day our daily bread." Our daily bread is God's gift to us. Jesus goes on in Matthew chapter 6 and verse 25. I'm not going to read the whole passage, but just sometime go and read the end of Matthew chapter 6. And Jesus basically says, quit fretting, quit worrying about all the stuff of your life. If God clothes the flowers and the birds of the air, do you not think he will take care of his children? He says, "Oh, you of little faith, therefore do not be anxious, saying, 'What shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear?' For the Gentiles seek after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them all. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you." Our Heavenly Father will give us whatever we need so we can be confident and daily enjoy his gifts. In The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Douglas Adams writes about Deep Thought, who's the powerful supercomputer tasked with determining, quote, "the answer to life, the universe, and everything." It takes the computer a long time to check and recheck its computations. In fact, it takes 7.5 million years, to be exact. But eventually, it spits out a simple, unambiguous answer. The meaning, the answer to life, the universe, and everything, the meaning of life is 42. 42, somebody yells at that computer. Is that all you've got to show for 7.5 million years of work? Deep Thought replies, "I've checked it and rechecked it very thoroughly. And that quite definitely is the answer. I think the problem, to be quite honest with you, is that you've never actually known what the question is." Deep down, everyone wants to know the meaning of life. But to get to the right answer, you have to ask the right question, and you have to do it in the right way. This is our quest in Ecclesiastes, to come to a true, accurate understanding of life, the universe, and everything, which hopefully will take less than 7.5 million years. I know for some of you who have sat through my sermon series before, you may be questioning if I can do it that quick, but I promise you we will. We'll either finish it or somebody will put us in a box before we get there, one or the other. But we shouldn't leave Ecclesiastes 1 without remembering Jesus entered into all the vanity and vexation of life under the sun to show us the wise way to live. Isn't it interesting that in light of what we've learned about wisdom in this book, that in John chapter 1, verse 14, it'll say that Jesus was God's wisdom made flesh, dwelling among us, the fullness of deity in bodily form. Isn't it interesting that Jesus will say to his disciples in John 14, 6, "I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life." Isn't it interesting in Isaiah 53:11 will say of the Messiah that by his knowledge the righteous one will save the many? And isn't it interesting that Jesus, in concluding the greatest sermon ever preached, the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew chapter 7, verses 24 to 29, will say that the wise man will build his house on Jesus and on his words? See, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of true wisdom. And that's why humility and teachability is the hallmark of true wisdom. And Jesus will say in Matthew 11, "Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am humble and I will give you rest for your souls." If we follow the wisdom of Jesus, life will eventually add up. It'll never add up to something as simple as 42. And it may not ever seem to add up on this side of eternity. But leave the final calculations to Jesus, and he'll make sure all the books balance in the end, including your personal account, which he reconciled, might I add, by his own blood. So look to Jesus, the author and finisher of your faith, and find the answers to all of life's questions being found in Him. May God grant this morning that we would be truly wise and seek Him as the one who alone can give us rest for our souls.